Okay. Shall I just start? Well, you want to introduce me?
Sure. Yeah.
Go ahead and introduce me. I'll finish my last line.
All right. So it's a pleasure to have Matt Strassler here today from Rutgers University, and he will tell us about symmetries and asymmetries that they have in Palermo.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It's all right.
So the talk is a little bit, well, I should say, I haven't talked about this stuff before. So whenever you talk about something for the first time, you know, timing is not necessarily going to work out quite right. I hope I'll be able to cover everything effectively. And this is an audience which is a little mixed, so I'm going to try to be sensitive to that. That will also require a little bit of juggling topics. But let me explain what I'm going to try to do. There are a lot of reasons to think about asymmetries at Hadron Colliders. In particular, the asymmetries I'm going to be focusing on are asymmetries in charge, more plus than minus, or something like that, and in direction, more things forward than backward, for example. There are obviously good reasons to think about asymmetries experimentally. A lot of things cancel. In the particular case of a Hadron Collider, detectors are very complicated, so some certain detector effects sometimes cancel out to some approximation. You have to know to what approximation. And also, certain types of backgrounds, which are always huge, sometimes cancel out or cancel partially, leaving you more sensitivity to a signal or some way to cross-check a signal. And in addition, it's a physics diagnostic. Once you have a signal, the charge asymmetry permits you, or the forward backward asymmetry permits you, to get some handle on what it is that you're looking at. And I hope that'll become clear. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a somewhat extensive introduction. This is partly for those in the audience who are not really keeping up to date daily on what's going on in Hadron Collider physics, need a reminder how these things really work, but also partly to lay out, let's say theoretically, the basic principles about that lie behind thinking about asymmetries, where they come from, why they're there, and what they tell you. After I have done that, and specifically illustrated in the context of angle asymmetries at the Tevatron, angle of forward-backward asymmetries at the Tevatron, I'll move to a specific discussion of the asymmetries in top physics, which you may have heard about, which are quite exciting, because this is one of the first places that we have fairly compelling discrepancy from what we think the standard model is supposed to do. And so there are a lot of questions as to what's going on there. And along the way, after briefly discussing the experimental situation, I'll mention a little bit about models that try to explain this via some new physics. Now, what I'll then do is I'll talk about two papers that I have written in the last, during 2011. The first is just on my own in January, looking at the possibility of measuring, well, if you've measured back, forward, backward asymmetries in one type of quark, you'd like to measure them in another type of quarks. The only quarks which that would be accessible are bottom and charm. And it turns out that we're just on the edge. We have just enough data, I'll claim, that we can probably do this, although it's not an easy measure. But this is something which should be done at the Tevatron. And then I'll talk about sort of simultaneously about the asymmetries that you can look for at the LHC, which are charge asymmetries on the whole, and how you can use those charge asymmetries fairly generally, but specifically to exclude models of this type. And I'll focus on one model, and that's a paper that I wrote recently with Nathaniel Craig and John Killich. John is a postdoc at Rutgers, and Nathaniel is a joint postdoc at Rutgers in the Institute for Advanced Study. Okay, so without further ado, what's the point? So what's the key difference between the Tevatron and the LHC? The Tevatron is a PP bar collider. Proton, antiproton. Okay, so that means we have some symmetries around. This initial state is CP symmetric, but it's not C and P symmetric separately. If I apply parity to it, the proton switches which direction it's coming from the left instead of the right. And if I apply charge conjugation, the same thing. I switch protons and antiprotons. So it's CP symmetric, but not C and P. Whereas the LHC is a proton-proton machine, so that's not CP or C symmetric, but it's parity conjugate, parity symmetric. So these simple principles we will now use to learn various things. So what it tells you in particular is that at a PP collider, it's always the case that if you measure the cross-section for some process, and you, the total cross-section, and you measure the total cross-section for the conjugate process, they're equal. But it does not have to be the case, for example, that if you measure a differential cross-section with respect to some angle, that that will be equal, in general, will not be equal to the same, the conjugate process with respect to the same angle. It will be equal to the same process at the conjugate angle. Did I do this wrong? No, I did it right. It will be equal to d sigma bar d theta tilde, where theta tilde, if here's my beam pipe direction, and I look at some particle that's going out with some angle theta, and I call this the conjugate angle theta tilde, right? These things will be equal because that's C and P together. But if I apply only C and not P, I can get something asymmetric.
Sorry, the beam pipe is the x-axis?
The beam pipe is this direction, yeah. Okay, so that's for Tevatron. For the LHC, the situation is completely different. There's absolutely no reason the cross-section for a certain process should be the same as the cross-section for the conjugate process. And in general, it's not. So this leads us naturally to think about four backward asymmetries at the Tevatron and charge asymmetries at the LHC. Notice that because it is symmetric right front to back, you can't have a different cross-section for something going this way, something going forward, and the same process going backward. Those are always equal. But in general, sigma does not equal sigma bar, and more generally, d sigma doesn't equal d sigma bar throughout the entire system.
Sorry,
maybe put a slash in the equals. Your
equations and your words. My words, okay. This mat is that one. That one doesn't, and that one doesn't. Thank you. All right. That would be very confusing when equals is not, it's the same as not equals. Okay, good. All right, so now to diagnose this a little more carefully. So the first point is that although a proton-proton or proton-antiproton collider is a collision of very complicated things, it is, for all practical purposes, when you're studying high-energy physics, an independent set of colliders which are really quark-antiquark or quark-gluon or gluon-gluon colliders. You can sort of think of it as a classical superposition of many colliders all sort of going on at once. Because all the processes that we study dominantly are given by a 2-to-2 partonic process, where parton means quark, gluon, or anti-quark. So because of this, we tend to prefer, let's see, I have to be a little careful here with blackboard usage. This will go down. That may turn out to be the best. Okay, so good. So now how do we describe what types of colliders we have, crudely speaking, inside of the LHC or the Tevatron? We do it first by figuring out what's in a proton. And what's in a proton is given by the parton distribution functions. And just to remind you what they look like and what they mean, if I have a proton heading this way with some momentum vector, k mu, basically because it's highly boosted, it looks like a pancake. And inside this pancake, there are lots of partons. If I pick out parton of a particular type, let's say a quark, I'll just call that type A because it won't really matter whether it's a quark or a gluon or an anti-quark. It has some fraction, it has momentum vector, which is some fraction x of the proton's momentum vector, to a very good approximation. It's basically traveling in the same direction. It has some particular fraction. And there is a probability distribution. It's not at all trivial that you can describe things this way. It's a consequence of complicated things in QCD. But it is true that to a good approximation, you can describe, you can use a function in calculations, which is the probability to find a parton of type I, type A, with momentum fraction x. And where x runs, obviously, from 0 to 1. And if we actually, let me make it a little bigger. If I sketch what these parton distribution functions roughly look like for different types of objects, so this is quite schematic, because you can't really draw, these things vary so quickly that you can't really put them on a plot very conveniently. But roughly speaking, the big one at low x
is the gluon. At high X, you've got the up quark and a little smaller the down quark. And then you've got all the other ones, the U bar, the D bar, the S bar. They're not exactly equal, but they're roughly equal. So the gluons dominate at low X. All, if you look at very low momentum particles in the proton, they're all gluons. Or gluons that have split into quark-antiquark pairs, which is why you get quark-antiquark pairs down here. There are fewer of them than gluons. And there are just as many quarks as antiquarks down here. It's only when you look up at very high energies you really realize the proton has some extra, has valence quarks in it at all. And obviously there's more U's than D's, but not exactly twice, as those functions are more complicated than that. Okay. It's only exactly twice if you integrate these functions, but point to point it's not twice. Okay, and notice that U's and D's are the same when you go to low X. They only become different at relatively high X. Okay, so that's the, these are the Parton distribution functions. Now, we're interested not in the structure of the proton. We're interested in what types of colliders we have in the proton or proton-antiproton colliders. So for this, we define something called a Parton luminosity. And, or actually, it's really Parton luminosity, but most people don't like to say Parton twice. So I will often drop the second term. But it's a Parton-Parton luminosity. That is, the you know, at what fraction of the time are proton-proton collisions gluon-gluon collisions, or quark-antiquark collisions? So to be precise, if I have a collision of proton A carrying momentum x1 and another B carrying momentum x2, that means the center mass energy at the partonic level, the parton center of mass energy, is equal to the collider center of mass energy times the square root of x1, x2. So if I'm interested in knowing, in my 7 TeV LHC, what fraction of the collisions give me a gluon-gluon collision at 1 TeV, what I need to do is fix the parton center mass energy at 1 TeV, but then I can partition the energy differently between the two partons. I could have a parton which from coming from this side with most of the energy and very little from that side, or vice versa. And I convolute those things together, fixing the energy, and that tells me the luminosity at a fixed parton center of mass from a particular pair of initial state partons. So if I now ask, if I take these luminosities at a PP bar machine for particle A to collide with particle B, what's going to dominate? Well, at a PP bar machine, what's going to dominate is QQ bar collisions. In particular, there's more up quarks in the proton, more up anti-up quarks in the antiproton, so dominantly, UU bar is going to be the largest, at least if I'm at high energy. And then after that, UD bar, which will be the same as DU bar, and then DD bar. These will in turn be bigger than U or D colliding with a gluon, which in turn is bigger than glu-glu, except at low energy. As I get down to lower energy, the gluons actually start to dominate. But for high energy physics, the very highest energy physics, this is the situation I'm in. And finally, there are other sorts of things like QQ or Q bar, where one of the quarks or one of the antiquarks has to be pulled from the C quarks, which have low parton distribution functions. Okay, so what do I learn from this? I learn that a proton-proton collider has a lot of quark-antiquark collisions at high energy, and that they tend to be from up quarks more than down quarks. And that's going to be important. Okay, what about the LHC? The LHC is completely different, because everywhere I see an antiquark here, I have to switch it with a quark. So here, it's UU collisions, which are bigger than UD collisions, and that's bigger than DD. Again, quark glue is important, followed by glue glue. But again, if you're at low energy, glue glue is the most important. So there's some transition between where this is important and that's important, low energy versus high energy. And finally, QQ bar comes in down here. Now, this is really important because, for example, if you're making a Z prime, some heavy particle that is made from quark-antiquark, you make it easily at the LHC, at the Tevatron. You make it much less easily at the LHC, relatively speaking. If you're making Higgs bosons, you're trying to make them with gluons. so that doesn't bother you so much. But for many other particles, proton is not as good as proton-antiproton. The converse to that is that you have to make a lot of antiprotons to have an antiproton collider, and that's very expensive and difficult. So this is the trade-off that one had to decide in building the LHC. Okay, but the consequences of this are interesting. Okay, so let's go through a couple of examples. When did I start? I don't want to over or under. Okay, somewhere between 5 and 10 past. I'll try to stick to that. I'll definitely be able to. Well, no, not one right here. Let's fill that one up. Actually, this is what I wanted to put over here. Okay, so let's look at the Tevatron. So I will orient my collider so the protons are coming from the left. And let's take a couple of examples. First example, W production. So how do I make W's? UD bar initial state produces a W plus. Okay, define the diagram being, of course, UD bar goes to W. Now, that's not the only way I can do it. I could have D bar U also makes a W plus. And then I could have the conjugate processes. U bar D makes a W minus or a D U bar makes a W minus. Now, which ones of these are big? Well, this one's big. And this one is not. Right? This is an up quark inside a proton. This is an anti-down quark inside a proton. That's disfavored. Meanwhile, over here, this one is a down quark inside an antiproton. That's disfavored. And then this one is still favored. Now, the cross-sections for these are obviously equal, the total cross-sections. But they are not as symmetric as I've drawn them in angle. Because the parton distribution function for up quarks is stiffer than for down quarks. They're more up quarks at slightly higher energies than for down quarks. So when I produce this W, it actually tends to be moving this way. And this W minus tends to be moving that way. A little bit. It's not a huge effect, but it's there. So if I define an asymmetry, so sigma W plus is the same as sigma W minus in total. But if I define an asymmetry for W plus is moving this way, plus, and this is the way I'll always define my asymmetries, I'll combine this with the conjugate process, which is W minus is moving that way. And I subtract from that sigma W plus moving this way, plus sigma W minus moving that way, divide by the same thing with a plus sign. That defines a forward-backward asymmetry, and that's not zero. Now, notice there is no sort of intrinsic asymmetry in the amplitude. This is an asymmetry which comes from the PDFs themselves. So this is what I will call a PDF-induced asymmetry. Now, I want to contrast that with the case of the Z boson. So if you produce a Z boson, these are the dominant processes, up quark or down quark from the proton, corresponding antiquarks from the antiproton. There's no intrinsic asymmetry having to do with the PDFs because, I mean, you just see it's completely symmetric. And besides, Z is self-conjugate, so you know what are we going to talk about here? But Z then decays to leptons, let's say. And the amplitude for Z for quark antiquark goes to Z, goes to leptons, has an intrinsic parity asymmetry, just in the amplitude itself. So if we were just if we produced the Z's at rest, the Z's would then even there produce. Let's see. Do you remember the sign? I was trying to remember this earlier. There, it is more likely, I think, that electrons go forward relative. No, sorry, let me draw it the other way. QQ bar. if the electrons go forward relative to the quark. It might be that they go backward relative to the quark moron. That I've forgotten. But there is an asymmetry, just intrinsic in the amplitude. Now, when we go to the collider, that remains, although it gets a little complicated, because of the fact that in some collisions, the Z boson is at rest, but most of the time it's not, because typically either the up quark or the anti-up quark has larger energy than the other one. So the Z ends up shifting a little bit to the left or right. And so when it decays, what you actually observe is that it's actually moving this direction, let's say. And so one of the quarks goes this way, and the other may go off like that. It doesn't have to be a balance of Z momentum. Right. So but there are two things that you can do in terms of defining an asymmetry. Both of them are interesting. The first one is, look, you can fully reconstruct where the Z boson is. You know all of its decay products. So you know it was moving this way. So you can shift to the rest frame of the Z. And you can measure the angle here in the rest frame. And you can compute an asymmetry for the probability for the electron to be going this way. And what I'm going to do from now on.
Is it actually balanced electron?
Yeah.
So how much worse is it compared to LEP measurements so far?
Oh, it doesn't compare to LEP, but it's still pretty good. I've never actually looked at that number. It doesn't come close enough to LEP that it gets exciting, but it's pretty good. These W charge asymmetries are also measured pretty well, and of course, those are unique to Teletron. They're really used to measure the partial distribution functions. Right, so what I'm going to do, so here I've actually written out carefully what I mean by my asymmetry. I'm combining things in particular ways. I'm always going to do that. I'm always combining a process with its conjugate, with the appropriate flip of angle or whatever it is that I need to do. I won't write that every time, but just keep in mind I'm always doing that. So here, the interesting issue is to compare electrons that are going forward versus electrons that are going backward and positrons in the Z bar, in the Z boson frame. That defines one asymmetry. Now, a separate question that we could ask is, because the electrons tend to go forward and the positrons tend to go a little more backward, relatively speaking, event by event, that doesn't necessarily mean that the electron that in the, well, let me say differently. If the electron in the rest frame is heading this way, that is to say forward, it doesn't mean that in the lab frame it'll be going forward, because it might be the Z particle is moving so that it's been shifted to the backward direction. But knowing the partial distribution functions, we could certainly predict, and of course we can certainly measure, what is the probability, sorry, what is the cross-section for an electron from a Z particle, all of these are electrons from Zs, to be going forward in the lab frame. Okay, that's a different number, because it has to account for this shifting of the Z particle event by event, integrated over all events. But it's still a calculable number and a measurable number. So both of these asymmetries are interesting. Now, the asymmetry here, though, is really coming from this process. It's an intrinsic amplitude-induced AFB. And those are quite distinct, as you see. Now, one thing they do have in common, though, is that the valence quarks are involved. And that's because if, in this case, if I were using C quarks instead of valence quarks, I could switch quark and anti-quark. And the valence quarks have different distributions. But for example, if this were coming from strange quarks, well, S and S bar have exactly the same distribution. Or at very low energy, even U and U bar have the same distribution. So there would be no way to pick up this angular effect. And in fact, that's also true here, because the reason I can pick out the quark direction here is that I know that this is the dominant process. But if I were to create a Z particle from an S, there's no preference for this over that. Right. Strange quarks and protons are just as common as anti-strange, not more or less. To a percent. I mean, it's not exactly true, but it's true to about a percent. So it's true. Well, it's true enough. Qualitatively speaking, this totally dominates. So, so if you see an asymmetry, whether it's PDF induced or amplitude induced, you are seeing an effect of the valence partons. And that is a very important thing to know, because if you see new physics that does that, you know something about it now. You know something about how it's produced, just from that. So it is always, for all measurements done at the LHC or the Tevatron, always important to measure the charge and forward backward asymmetries. And the fact that it's not done as a matter of course is something I think which still needs to be changed. It should be done for every single measurement that, where it's meaningful. Okay. So let's talk about a couple of more subtle cases that are going to be important. So first of all, it's wonderful to have all these boards, but boy, it does require some interesting memory abilities that I'm not sure I have. We'll see how this is going to work. Okay, so let me talk about TT-bar. TT-bar is interesting. I'm going to talk about it in two steps. The first step is to talk about it at tree level. And then I'll consider quantum corrections to it only after making a physics point about something else. All right, so how do we produce top quarks? Well, there's two mechanisms, and which one is dominant is different at the LHC than at the Tevatron. At the Tevatron, partly because the luminosity for the Parkin luminosity for gluons is relatively small at the high energies needed, and also because the QQ bar initial state is common, the dominant production for TT bar at the Tevatron is QQ bar to TT bar, and glu to TT bar is smaller. At the LHC, it's exactly reversed, because relatively speaking, the top is lighter, so there's more gluons around at the relevant energy, and there are not many QQ bar initial states. Now, let's start with the glu. Okay. I told you that if you want an asymmetry, you need the initial, you need the valence quarks. You're not going to get an asymmetry from gluons, right? I mean, there's just no way. Just draw it, right? I mean, you start with glu. What can you flip? Okay. There can't be any asymmetry there. Now, a little more subtle is this one. There's no PDF-induced asymmetry because this is like this case, right? I have UU bar and DD bar, so I'm not balancing one PDF against a different one. That could give me some asymmetry. So if there's an asymmetry, it has to come from the amplitude. Now, is there one? Well, there was in this case because the Z has parity violation. There isn't in this case because the gluon doesn't. But it's important to keep track of why.
So you can exchange the Z from a smaller value.
Second? Yes, there is, of course, a small contribution from Z, but that is not that will not be important.
But I mean, it's just smaller, it?
Well, color octet versus color singlet weak, it's a big suppression. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's not, we don't need to worry about it. Yeah, the higher order creep. Okay, so if we have QQ bar goes to TT bar, now, the thing is, here we do have the valence quarks, and it is not, for the reasons that we saw, out of the question that there might be some effect that we have to keep track of. And the thing that we have to be careful of is that I said it was parity violation here, but it's a little more subtle than that. If you just ask about the initial and final state, I don't need parity violation by itself. Because think about what's going on in this process. It's a little bit like E plus E minus goes to mu plus B minus, which is maybe a little easier to think about. So I've got an initial current. In the case of E plus E minus, it would be literally an electric current. Here I have a color current, and it's flowing this direction. And when I'm done, if, let's say, the top quark goes off in this direction, so the color starts here and ends up flowing there, and the anti-color starts here and ends up flowing there, the current has changed its angle by some, has changed direction by some angle. Consequently, there's some radiation, which has to do with that angle, and some quantum effects, which are less obvious to think about. If I switch the angle to the conjugate direction, it is not obvious, in fact, it's not true, but this is the same situation. The current has been accelerated by much more. So there is no reason that it needs to be, and indeed it isn't, symmetric. So in fact, the puzzle at first glance is, why is this case symmetric? Right? In fact, there's no reason that it has to be. Another way to say that is that although we have CP conservation here, the initial state is not C or P symmetric itself. So I can't operate with parity on the final state, leaving the initial state the same, and think there won't be a difference.
So the spin of the object is not important? I mean, is the statement would be true also for, say, if there were scalar?
I believe it is not important. I don't see why it should be. This is really an argument about currents. I think it's true. And we should double check it, but I think it's true. I'm going to give you another argument which will sort of show that it really shouldn't depend on the spin. So, but we'll first try to understand why don't we get an asymmetry here. And the reason is that we're going through an intermediate state, which is a gluon, which is a C eigenstate. Happens to be C equals minus 1. But as a consequence of that, the amplitude for this process squared is C invariant. And if it's C invariant, it's P invariant, because the whole thing is CP invariant. Okay? So it's a consequence of having one particle here that has special properties. And it's that property here which wasn't true for the Z. Okay, so we do get a symmetric process at this leading order, tree level. So no asymmetry at tree level. Okay, now I will question that soon. But before we do that, let me remark that this is actually practically useful. Okay? In particular, in looking for a very interesting standard model process, which is single top quark production. So how do you produce one top quark at a time? I'll only draw the largest process. The largest process is actually not the first one you might think of. It's this one. You start with an up quark, and it turns into a down quark and an off-shell W plus. A gluon comes along and splits into a bottom quark and an anti-bottom quark, fuses with the W, and creates a top. It's actually bigger than the S-channel process you might have guessed about, which would be UD bar goes to TB, TB bar. Okay? Bigger by a factor of 2. And the reason is valence quark, gluon, no suppression on the parton luminosities, that's good. This B quark there's some logarithmic enhancement here. Okay, it's not entirely obvious, but it is true. It's bigger. T-channel processes often are. This is basically T-channel W exchange versus S-channel W exchange. And you often win with T-channel. Okay, keep looking for chalk, but I have to remember it's down here. All right, now this process is obviously asymmetric. First of all, what are the various processes that we have here? Well, we could take the conjugate process the dominant situation is that this up quark is coming from a proton, not the antiproton. So the dominant situation is that we have an up quark recoiling against the gluon, and that's going to make a top quark that goes this direction rather than backward. The converse situation, where we have a gluon and we have an anti-up quark, is going to make a T bar going backward. Now, of course, we could have a down quark and a gluon. In that diagram, I would have a down quark here and an up quark there. So I would have a W minus. And therefore, I would have to convert, I would have to switch the Bs and the B bars here, and this T would turn into a T bar. So there is the probability that the down quark, which still has a higher PDF at these high energies than the gluon, and so the down quark tends to be harder than the gluon, it will push the top quark this way. But it's an anti-top quark. So what is the implication here? Well, remember, there are more up quarks than down quarks. So it's still true. Even though up quarks will make top quarks that go this way, and down quarks will make top bars that go that way also, there's more tops than anti-tops produced because there's more ups than downs. So there is an overall tendency for top quarks to be produced this way and anti-top quarks to be produced that way at the Tevatron. Now, why is this important? It's because of how you search for these things. This is a relatively large cross-section, but still, there's comparable cross-sections from, there's somewhat larger cross-sections from TT bar, and a big cross-section from W plus jets and that mimic the signal. So to dig this thing out, you've got to get rid of all that stuff. So your backgrounds, again, are W plus jets and TT bar. Okay, so what do you do? So one thing you might try to do is you go to higher energy, you sort of cut away low energy events, and you reconstruct top quarks. You try to find a top quark in the kinematics. That, of course, should remove some fraction of W plus jets. But you still have lots of top quarks around because TT bar is not removed by this cut. However, TT bar is symmetric. So when a top quark decays, and now it depends on how you find these things, when a top quark decays, what are you going to do to find it? You're going to look for the case where the top quark, which decays to BW, produces a lepton. And so since there are equal numbers of tops and antitops in both directions, there are going to be equal number of positive and negative leptons in both directions. But that's not true for your signal. So effectively, you use the asymmetry on the lepton that you observe coming from one or both top quarks in the case of the background, the one top quark in the case of the signal, to knock down TT bar. And finally, you look for this hard jet, which is going forward and is also correlated in direction, so it also has an asymmetry.
So the reason that CMS saw single top production so quickly is just because they have a huge enhancement of what we do in Python?
So this is still Tevatron. Let me come back to that question.
When
you say they saw it, I mean, this is another one of those cases where you got to believe a very complicated multivariate analysis, and I don't know whether I do. It's borderline.
But it's the same process dominance?
It's the same process. It is this one. Yeah. This is the dominant one at LHC as well.
Have they measured this for backward asymmetry for single? Is it too small?
It's hard to say that because the measurement uses it. So you're assuming it in order to extract the cross-section. You can't separately measure it at this point. Okay. Now, you might worry, since I've sort of hinted at it, that to do this, you'd better be sure that TT bar is symmetric. And it's not exactly symmetric, even in the standard model. So let's understand why. So this brings me to my next stage in my... The topics get shorter and shorter as I go. So... All right, so why is there a forward backward asymmetry? So the reason is that once you go to the next order, you're adding diagrams together like this. Now this has a one gluon state in the middle. That's a charge eigenstate. This has two gluons in the middle. That's a different charge eigenstate. This is charge minus. This is charge plus. Now the amplitude as a whole is no longer a C eigenstate. So when I act with charge conjugation, I don't get the same answer. Which I argued to you was allowed, and it was sort of an accident of one gluon exchange that it was not that wasn't the case. But once you allow two gluon exchange, these things have different charge conjugation, so there's parity. You get an amplitude induced for backward asymmetry. Okay, and also radiation, even sort of semi-classical radiation. Is also induced for the reason that I gave, which is a little more intuitive, which is that if I now consider also the possibility that I radiate a gluon off of one of these lines, if I have a current and it changes by a certain angle, then I go to the conjugate angle, there's more acceleration of the charge, so therefore the radiation pattern is different. So both radiation of gluons and also quantum corrections to the original process contribute to the asymmetry. And actually, this one's larger, it turns out. So if you estimate it, as some people did from the other one, you actually get the wrong sign.
So it's like effective axial.
I haven't thought about it that way. I can't do that on the fly. But
three gamma matrices.
Well, yeah. When I look at the interference here, right? If I take this times its conjugate,
so it's like interference of vector and axial.
What's very interesting is if I square the graph, what I'm really looking at here is the triangle graph. So this is proportional. It's fascinating. It's proportional to DABC, which is why it's present in QED, and it's present in QCD. But it wouldn't be true in SU2 or SPN or SLN. It's sort of fascinating. I would like to understand precisely why. I mean, it has to do with the charge conjugation properties here. But I'd like to understand this a little better. Okay. That was an aside for experts. Okay, let's come back to the original schedule program. All right, so what? So Kuhn and Rodriguez, I think, were the first ones to calculate this. And they found, so just as for Z, we have two different frames we could calculate the asymmetry in.
And this comes back to Brodsky.
In QED, and they go all the way back to, I think you are right. In the case of the top quark specifically, it was calculated by, so thanks for reminding me of that. But Kuhn and Rodriguez are the first paper that I know about that really tries to do it. And what they say is that if you calculate the asymmetry for the top quarks in the TG bar frame, the same way we would calculate the asymmetry for electrons in the Z frame, the asymmetry in the standard model should be about 8% to 7%, depending on whether you're working at relatively low energies like the invariant mass of the top quarks around 500 GeV versus the invariant mass of the top quarks around 1,000 GeV. Okay, and that's intrinsic to the amplitude. And then if you put this calculation in a particular collider, like the Tevatron, and you account now for all of the Parton distribution functions and the shifting of the events front to back as the event frame differs from the lab frame by a boost along the beam pipe, there you get something like 5%. Okay, so that was. And now these numbers have changed a little bit as people have resummed calculations, and I don't have the precise numbers, but the details are not going to matter. And we could argue about this, because this calculation, although it's a one-loop calculation, is the leading order calculation of a quantity which was zero at tree level. And therefore, it is potentially subject to a large correction at the next order. But that's a two-loop computation that nobody's done. So one should be a little cautious about knowing guessing what the error bar is here from the purely theoretical point of view.
Well, they did the soft Euler summation.
Yeah, so the question
pushes it up to about 7%.
Right. It doesn't seem like there's room for a big correction. But still, you know, this is one of the questions that's out there because somebody did the measurement. In fact, the history is that in 07, at the end of 07, beginning of 08, CDF, one of the experiments at the Tevatron, and D0, the other one, both reported on these numbers. And they were a little uncomfortably high, but nothing yet to get excited about. This was 24% plus or minus 14. And this was high, but with larger errors. I was uncomfortable sort of quoting a number here because I'm not sure you'd be comparing apples with apples. They didn't quote the numbers in quite the same way. Maybe somebody else actually knows that. But the point is, the errors were big enough that you would see, well, it's a little high, but you know, things fluctuate.
It's a two-sigma, one.
I just did this backwards. Sorry. I meant to put that in the other. This is the zero statement.
This was 2007?
Yeah. 2007 and 8. Let's see. And in the lab frame, CDF said 17 plus or minus 8. Okay. Now, in 2011, starting in 2010, there were rumors that CDF had rather large numbers, and they presented something at ICHEP in the middle of 2010. The paper actually finally appeared at the beginning of 2011, and that generated a lot of excitement. Because what they said is, if you first take the TT bar system, you reconstruct the whole event, and you take the invariant mass bigger than 450 GeV, which is not that much. I mean, top quarks are, you know, two top quarks, 350 already. So they're not moving that fast, but you're going up a little bit. And there's good reasons to do that, because near threshold, a lot of asymmetries tend to vanish. What they find is that in the TG bar frame, they get 47.5 plus or minus 11.4%. And they claim that with their measurement and the best up-to-date standard model result, that same number would have been 0.088 plus or minus 0.013. Well, so I guess it's consistency. 8.8% plus or minus 1.3%. Okay, so that's significant. And you look at the data by eye, and it looks pretty robust. And it's an asymmetry, so you don't immediately think of something that's going to, you know, we might screw up tops, but not anti-tops. Right? There's something wrong with your lepton identification. Maybe you'd it's not so easy to figure out something that gives an asymmetry of this type. It mucks up the leptons that are going this way in such a way that's consistent with the anti-leptons going that way. That's the whole point of doing an asymmetry. So it's hard to think of a detector effect. Now, what else could it be? One doesn't jump to new physics lightly. Right? Well, it could be a QCD correction. I mean, the error bars here are still pretty big. Right? You wouldn't be surprised if the central value, after a few more measurements, settled down at 25% or even 20. That happens. And then it wouldn't be so far from this, but it still, you know, if it goes down to 20 and the error bar is much lower, it'd still be 3 sigma. So it's uncomfortable. And so you could worry that maybe, you know, there is a big QCD correction, or maybe an electroweak correction, or just some subtlety in the standard model calculation. Somebody somehow never really quite figured out. People have been looking. Nothing's shown up. Could there be a problem of translating the measurement, which, of course, you don't observe this number, right? You observe data. And then you have to translate that into what the top and anti-top quark are doing. There's a lot of processing which goes on that. Having a Monte Carlo vision of the detector and a Monte Carlo vision of the actual detailed TT-bar production process and how the top quark decays and all of that stuff. And you could worry that maybe there's some significant subtlety that when they take an asymmetry that is really there and they try to reconstruct how much there must have been at the quark level to produce what they see in the detector, they're overestimating somehow. And some of them are blowing up this number, which is really 10%, into somehow something that looks that's much bigger. You know, if they're doing their job, you know, they're not doing that, right? I mean, they're supposed to do it carefully, and lots of people have thought about what they could have done, tried to find holes in it, and no one's found a hole yet. So this remains, you know, perhaps the most stable and robust mystery that we've got about the standard model right now. Okay, so people have, you know, tried to propose...
What about the energy without being some drink? Do they get, are they able to estimate that?
If you just look at the total cross-section?
Yeah.
The total cross-section as a function of this variable?
Yeah.
Is fine. There's no sign of any problem.
It fits.
Yeah.
Which, who are you using?
It fits in the sense that...
It's low.
Or is it fitted?
It's a little low. It's within 2 sigma. It's a little low.
If things agree within 2 sigma on a calculation which has got a tail on it, I mean, you know, we don't... Reconstructing top quarks fully when they're starting to have high boost involves understanding jets, and they're not using good jets. They have all sorts of technical problems. I mean, there's all sorts of subtleties there on that tail.
So the measurement is 7.5 picoburns, and the leading nextly orifice, next to leading long soft cooling is 6.3. So it's a little low. But there's errors.
There are subtleties, right. And
So
there's no sign of a structure. There's not like there's a wiggle in it.
The whole theory prediction is low compared to...
And there's different theory predictions, right? This is a new calculation which is lower than the previous ones, so that's controversial too. But a lot of things have to settle out. But it's really the issue of what's going on the tail. On the tail, it's not like there's some dramatic effect going on there. It's not some factor of 2 or 3 deviation. If there were, of course, we would be very excited. But I think it's still worth being moderately excited here. I mean, we can't easily get rid of this. It could be a statistical fluctuation, but it's a big one. And you can see it by eye. It's not like, you know, you've got to squeeze and wonder about it's a multivariate fit or it's on some falling distribution trying to see some little thing. No. This isn't, you can just stare at it. It's there.
What's the dependence on the threshold setting as energy, which you, the MCT?
It's not so striking once you go above 450. You lose statistics as you move up pretty quickly. But the asymmetry doesn't, you know, it's not all in the last 2 bins or something. It doesn't jump at you and say there's something strange in the data. And the data, event by event, is there in the paper. You can look at it. You don't immediately see something that looks bad. Okay. So now, what could be...
What's the overall sample of TT bar events about 400?
I mean, in terms of number of events?
Yes.
I don't know. It's hundreds. Yeah, I don't remember that. Okay, thank you. I don't want to spend too much time on that because I still haven't gotten to the stuff I want to tell you about. Okay. This is a long introduction, but it's necessary. Okay. So, models. And how are you going to explain this if you want to go to new physics? Well, the trivial thing to do is to write down tree-level diagrams. Now, we don't know, of course, this is some perturbative process if it's new physics, right? But everyone, of course, assumes that it is. So they say, all right, I've got, let's say, an up quark and an anti-up quark in my initial state, or maybe I've got a down quark and I've got an anti-down quark in my initial state. We want that because we're at high energy and we're running out of gluons at the Tevatron. So it's going to probably be a QQ-bar process. Remember, that has a high luminosity, so that's probably our best guess. And we also want an asymmetry, so glue wouldn't be so good. And then somehow these things have to turn into T and T-bar. Because we're reconstructing the events, we do really believe there are T's and T-bars in these events. You could not worry about that, but that seems to be the case. So the question is, what can you put here? Well, there's a finite number of channels. You can list them all. Right? You combine the colors and the charges. You look at S-channel exchange and S-channel exchange and T-channel exchange, and you come up with a finite list. There are particles like Z bosons. There are particles like W bosons. There are particles that are scalars that are in the color triplet or in the color sextet. You can put in particles in the S-channel that are like gluons. You can exhaust the list. A little exercise for the listener. Okay, I won't go through them all. They're all different.
Would you try to create a destructive interference with the first diagram?
Or there's two possibilities. There's several possibilities. Again, S versus T channel could be different. Depends how you do the coupling to the initial state and the final state, because there can be signs there. So I don't think I have a general answer for you, but the important point is that most of the attempts actually do interference. Some of them don't. They actually have an amplitude which does not interfere. So they actually need the square of something. So those have to be really big. The typical situation is, so let me give you a typical example, which is the one I'm going to focus on at the very end of the talk, which
can
is that you, let me just finish this, if you just give me a moment. So a typical situation would be something like this. This is a W prime. So this is actually a charge current interaction. It's sort of an interesting one. It has certain advantages, as you'll see, but a disadvantage, which is in some cases. But to give you a sense of scale, in order to get the asymmetry that we want, we need a coupling constant here of order 1.5, which means this is as strong as the strong interactions.
For which mass of W?
For a mass of W of order 600 GeV, which is enough to put it out of reach of the Tevatron in some sort of direct study. But not out of reach of LHC. Okay?
Is that supposed to be a U1 W prime?
No.
It's an SU2.
So
in this case.
Another SU2 very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be SU2 right?
Yes, they're going to couple these to right handed to avoid problems. Most of them, yeah, they're going to do that. That's the sensible thing to do.
Okay.
There are Z prime models that people have proposed, right, that were just a U1. And not an SU2, but Z prime, which you couple to U and T, has the problem, which we'll actually see something similar to in a moment. But if you have a Z prime that couples to U and T, it doesn't just make UU bar goes to TT bar, it also makes UU goes to TT. And that was just ruled out yesterday by CDI. Well, okay, ruled out to some degree, and now you can argue about whether there's any room left or not. But there was just a measurement announced yesterday,
or
the day before.
Which ruled out?
This process. Because this gives...
Was that previously claimed?
Well, people have talked about the fact that this was a way that you could get a limit on this particular process, because you get same sign leptons, and that has very low standard model backgrounds.
What was the expectation? Ruled out for what mass of the Z prime?
Well, if you switch this UU to a UU bar, you get an amplitude which would interfere with this and give you a certain asymmetry. Given that you want an asymmetry of a certain size, and I haven't gone through this model in detail, that fixes the mass and times the coupling, and that's the only thing which comes in here. So it's fixed.
That's
and that's
so you say the W prime is not.
W prime is not, because you don't have this process.
Yeah.
I can't switch D and T here. The charges are wrong.
I don't understand why can't you have U, T, and then U bar, T bar?
You can. But the point is, this is an additional process that's excluded by data.
No, you can't forbid this.
You can't forbid this.
So
you need a charged object here.
Of sort of non-balance.
It's not even a valence thing. It's just the fact that there's so little background for
you
same sign dilemma.
You from LHC?
Tevatron.
So
although
you,
LHC
you
is already,
you
I think LHC is basically
a non-balance quark, right?
Yeah, it's still big enough.
You need quite a big CKM matrix angle for that.
So.
You're
basic. So I'll come back to that at the very end.
Okay.
which is coming scarily close. Okay, I do want to tell you something. Okay, so that's
my question.
Okay, as long as this is coming out of my, as long as the question time is additional time, then I.
Yeah. So there will have to be time before, before threshold that we get have to get out of this room. Or?
Well, I think when people are coming knocking at the door, we should leave.
But yeah, is there a similar to 2:30 issue?
Okay, so if 2:30 is a hard deadline, let's keep moving. But okay, we'll
have an hour.
So it was mentioned before, like the muon exchange in the amplitude.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that just by itself, the three level, it can produce the asymmetry,
yes.
And you needed the second order effect.
Right.
So since it is a second order effect, how does it compete with the Z exchange?
It's still larger.
It's still much larger, or
remember. So first of all, the Z exchange doesn't interfere with this, because the Z exchange is color singlet, and this is color.
No, that's true. But
the point is that you're comparing this with the square of the Z amplitude.
Yes.
So it's down.
Yeah,
I think it's. I don't have the number off the top of my head. But, I mean, it's compared to the numbers we're talking about here, it's another
factor.
I think it's going to be something like a factor of alpha over alpha s times a factor of 8, crudely. So we're talking about a factor of 100. Okay, so good. So now, models is not really what I came here to talk about. The question is, what do we do? Well, one thing you want to do is if you could measure the asymmetry in other quarks, that would be nice because different models predict different things. Some models predict that you're adding something in here which couples to all the quarks in some sort of flavor-blind way. So you get the same asymmetry, or roughly, but the same asymmetry for Bs and Cs as you do for top. Others only couple to third generation, so that gives you an asymmetry in Bs. There are some which involve flavor symmetries that only involve the up, charm, and top quarks. They will give you asymmetries in charm. So it would be very nice to study B and C asymmetries. So I want to tell you very briefly the results of such a study. So before I start, let me say this was an extremely crude study. So anyone who really knows about how the study should be done will know the level of crudeness. But the justification for that is partly, well, I had no time. I was essentially scooped. So I had to rush the thing out. But the other reason, more seriously, is that the numbers that a theorist can produce, no matter how hard I would work to try to make it better, are not going to be good enough. Really, the point of this is to motivate the experimentalists to look at it carefully. And I think one can do that. So the claim is that there's enough data at the Tevatron that you can measure forward backward asymmetries in bottom and charm to about the maybe 20 to 30% level, which given the size at 3 sigma, which given the size of this is exactly what you'd want to be able to do. Okay. Now that's not with a careful statement about anything, but let's just give you the numbers. So the idea here was to take diejet events, for example, proton-proton goes to bottom quark, anti-bottom quark, is an example. So we're going to want to select diejet events that are high enough energy that we're sensitive to the QQ bar region. We're not interested in glue-glue, that won't have an asymmetry. And since we already know that M top at 450 looks interesting, let's choose the diejet mass to be 450, and we'll choose the PTs here large enough the triggers are no issue. Okay, so that's our initial selection. Now, how are we going to measure an asymmetry in quarks? I mean, jets are jets, right? You up quark jets, down quark jets, strange quark jets. You can't tell the difference. Gluons, you can tell the difference a little bit from quarks, but not much. And so how are we going to do things with Bs and Cs? Well, the key thing about Bs and Cs is that charm quarks have a probability to decaying to a muon. That is to say, charm goes to strange plus mu nu. And a charm quark will always decay to a mu plus, and anti-charm will always decay to a mu minus. So if you knew you were producing charm quarks, and you looked at the muon that you see inside a jet, which about a few percent of the time, that will happen, the charge of the muon tells you whether it was a charm jet heading this way, or a charm heading this way, or an anti-charm heading that way. So any asymmetry in charm translates directly to an asymmetry in muons inside a corresponding jet. Well, by the time you've accounted for the fact, you're actually going to need to detect those muons. It's not really 10, it's more like 10. But you've got to be able to measure it so forth and be comfortable that it's not from something else. So it ends up being a few percent, 5%, let's say. You could ask, what about electrons? The problem is electrons are much harder to measure inside of a jet at the Tevatron than muons are. The LHC detectors may be good enough to do that, but the Tevatron detectors are not. Okay.
Straight G-meson decays, and it was fine.
That's right. Now, bottom quarks is a little more complicated, because on the one hand, a bottom quark can go directly to a mu-minus, but it could also first decay to a charm quark, which would then decay to a mu-plus. And there's another subtlety, which is that a B-meson that's neutral can oscillate to an anti-B-meson. The effect of that is that you're taking a bottom anti-down state, sorry, bottom anti-up, bottom anti-down state and turning it into a down anti-bottom state. So effectively, you're converting a bottom quark to an anti-bottom quark. And so some fraction of the time, the charge is basically randomized by this mixing. And when you add it all up, the effect is that the, let's see here. This was perhaps not a good choice. So let me put that somewhere else. I've lost my eraser. Where'd it go? Thank you. Surfeit of riches here. Let's try this. Okay, so by the time you're done, what you find is, roughly speaking, an asymmetry that you measure in muons that are inside of a jet is, roughly speaking, the forward-backward asymmetry intrinsic in charm-anti-charm times the cross-section for charm-anti-charm to give you a muon, minus a third the forward-backward asymmetry for BB bar times the cross-section to have BB bar giving you a muon. Okay. Now, this is the numbers that actually come out of requiring this on dijets and also requiring there be a muon near a jet with PT greater than 20 and eta less than 2, for those who are interested. PT greater than 20 is enough that a lot of the really nasty things that could happen with muons are not so likely. And here are the numbers. So you find there's this amount of bottom and charm in that sort of sample, a fraction of a picobarn. Most of the events come from something else altogether. They're coming from light quarks with gluons, or gluons with gluons, where the gluons are splitting through QCD process into charm and bottom directly. So this is a gluon which splits, the gluon travels, splits to BB bar or CC bar, and then either the B or the B bar, or the C or the C bar, produces a muon, which is clearly charged random. And then you have this process where a quark can hit an antiquark, which is itself a B and C already in the proton. And that also is symmetric in charge, because these are C quarks. So that's a symmetric but nonetheless diluting background. And these are pretty big relative to those. But nonetheless, you've got 1.8 picobarns of cross-section total and 10 inverse femtobarns per experiment of luminosity, which is of order 18,000 events. So your errors are about 0.0, your statistical errors are about
0.7%. So those were
This is after this requirement. I'm not tagging on anything. That's true. I'm just looking at muons inside of jets. Yeah. So this is an interesting number, because what this tells you, let's look at the charm first. That's 1,500 charm events. So if I had a 30% asymmetry, I'd be talking roughly, something like 1,000 over 500. And that's in a sample of 18,000 whose 1 sigma is 135. So
I'm just surprised it's only a factor of 2 between BB bar and CC bar.
That has to do with these muon fractions, right? The muons the muons from charm are a little softer than the muons from Bs. But at 20 GeV, given PT cuts of 150, it's not surprising. Right? That's the only difference is just that the bottom quarks have harder muons than the charm quarks do, but not by enough to make it that big a difference. I mean, sorry, it's not just that they're harder. It's that you get twice. Sorry, I said it wrong. You get twice as many in a bottom quark, but they're also these guys are harder than those. It's complicated, but you can look at the spectra. It's not an unreasonable number. Okay, so if you have 1,500 here and you have a 30% asymmetry, you're going to see it. So already out of the box, without doing anything else, we have at least a statistically significant asymmetry if it's, say, 30%. at the three sigma level. Now, the systematic issues are important, because if that's all you did, you'd have an asymmetry of order 500 events in a sample of 18,000. That's, you know, a couple of percent, so 2.5%. You'd worry that maybe you have a detector issue, if that's the only thing you did. So you want to be able to enhance this to make it larger in absolute terms. You know, the observed asymmetry should get larger at the same sensitivity. You'd like to be more sensitive to bottom quarks. You have twice as many bottoms here, but your dilution factor is 3, so you're actually less sensitive to the bottom out of the box. So what do? Well, first of all, you can use tagging. Tagging will enhance your BB bar fraction relative to everything else. That can get you more sensitivity. How much, nobody knows, because nobody really knows about tagging in these energy scales. Tagging and mistagging are not fully known. So this is not a trivial measurement. You'll have to study this. You can raise the PT cut on the jets. That tends to reduce this background relative to these. So that doesn't get you much sensitivity increase. I find if you raise this to 225, the sigma goes down by 2, the background goes down by 4. So you don't get more sensitivity, but the size of your observed asymmetry goes up by a factor of 2. So that's still good. Okay? It removes systematic issues. And if you raise the ratio of the muon PT over the PT of the jet, you take the ratio of those two, and you put a cut there, that tends to reduce this part of the dilution factor in these. And so again, you get some increase in sensitivity. So you have several handles that you can play off against each other. And by reversing those cuts, you have a control sample. So I think you have all the ingredients that you need for measurement.
Are they going to pursue it?
One person has spoken to me about it. I'm going to try to give talks and convince people they should do it. Mm-hmm. That they should investigate it and check whether there's some deep problem with my numbers.
What about the other experiment? This was CDF?
Either CDF or D0 could do this. In fact, D0 is slightly better because their muon coverage is slightly better.
But the GT bar, is it coming from one experiment?
The numbers that I've shown you, D0 has not reproduced the CDF result yet.
But are they working on this?
You know, the number of people in these experiments is so small right now, I have no idea what's really happening. These are totally undermanned experiments now. They have a lot of work to do, like find the Higgs.
But it's not like D0 is at certain disadvantage relative to CDF.
It's the inclusive measurement, the only difference is the being. I haven't heard
of anything. I have no idea. They ought to.
They seem to be a top priority.
Yeah, you would think so. You would think so. Okay, so in my remaining minus 3 minutes, but I do hope you'll accept that accept the time given that there were a lot of questions. Let me say something about this W prime, which did I erase it or is it not still under here? Yeah. So this model. So there's a version of this attempt at explaining the forward-backward asymmetry, which is in some ways a very nice little model due to Catherine. I'll bring it back. I noticed that problem earlier. Jesse Shelton and Catherine Zurich wrote a little model down, which includes this mechanism for explaining the asymmetry, but also includes a coupling. Again, all these are right-handed quarks. I won't bother to write that. These are all right-handed quarks, or left-handed antiquarks, coupling to the W. And these are the only two couplings they put in, essentially. Well, they add a small one of a different sort to strange quarks. But basically, the dominant couplings in the right-handed CKM matrix are exactly flipped generationally to what you would naively expect. And they show that this is not excluded, which is cute. It doesn't create all sorts of flavor-changing neutral currents that, or through loops that you would cause problems. And in fact, it even gives you some corrections to B-quark physics, B-meson physics, which are beneficial. So they show several different anomalies that they can kind of all explain with the same model, plus the TT-bar asymmetry. Now, this could get you quite excited. And they are the ones using this 1.5 and 600-ish GeV. The only problem is they missed something, which is that once you have this, you also have the following process. And also, although it's not so important at the Tevatron, it's very important at the LHC2, this one. These are big.
Sorry, you mean W prime?
W prime, yes. These are big.
Do they require this
UV version? Yes, to explain all the B physics they do. Okay. Not to explain this.
Right.
Okay. But nonetheless, this is an interesting model because it seems to explain several things. Okay. So is it ruled out? Well, at the Tevatron, if you, so they sort of say G prime is 1.5 to 2. If it's 2, this is a huge effect. This doesn't interfere with the standard model process, so that increases, if you go from 1.5 to 2, there's a big increase in this rate. It's something like 5 or 6 times the standard model rate for a single top from this alone. So that's ruled out. If G prime is 1.5, it's still kind of maybe twice as big. It doubles the standard model rate. It's as big as the standard model. Is that ruled out? Well, that's tricky because it's a multivariate fit to make the measurement. It's probably excluded, but for me to check it, I would need the multivariate fit. So I can't say absolutely. But there's another point, which is that they're fitting a big asymmetry. And the asymmetry is a big error bar. So maybe the true asymmetry is a little bit smaller. And the asymmetry is coming through an interference effect. This is squared. So if the asymmetry went down by a factor of 2, this would go down by a factor of 4. And the Tevatron certainly doesn't rule out, 25 to even maybe 50% increase in the standard in single top reliably. So Tevatron, you can't really say it's totally wrong, totally ruled out.
As a theorist, do you give credit to this kind of completely naive attempts to write down an arbitrary flavor structure?
Well, they did a little better than that. If you look in the paper, it's a little
better than that. If anything, they did worse than that, because some of the claims in their paper were completely... They were treating the non-abelian gauge bosons as if they were abelian, and they're writing down completely arbitrary couplings in the flavor space, as if it were U1. It's completely, the paper was completely lunatic.
Okay, this is a strong claim. I'm prepared to be convinced. What I noticed before really going into the details of their paper was that this is ruled out for a different reason, which is that this structure, any structure like it, produces a huge... Let me just give you the numbers on what we would be talking about.
But yeah, this is a model-independent reason, I agree.
Yeah. And so independent of the question of whether you believe... I mean, it could be a question of the consistency, theoretical consistency of the model.
Yeah.
If you just think it's a fine-tuning issue, then I would say, well, let's just rule it out on experimental grounds. And that turns out to not be hard to do. And the reason is that at the LHC, the rates for these processes, if you really took these numbers seriously, would be the total would be 230 picobarns, which is bigger than TT bar, would be ruled out by a lot. But again, I would be interested in ruling it out by better than a factor of 4, just to be sure, to put the nail in. So here are the numbers that come from a study, which uses the fact that the really cool thing about this process is it's hugely asymmetric. Almost all of this production is T and not T bar, right? Because you're starting with UD initial state. And there's no corresponding U bar, D bar. So this is essentially all T's. Okay? And here are some numbers for you to look at. If I select events at the LHC with a single lepton, that means an E or a mu, not a tau, with these conditions, a little bit of missing ET, 2 or more jets with PT greater than 30, these are the numbers in picobarns that I get. All right, so it's dominated by W plus and minus. Notice that's asymmetric in charge, as it is allowed to be at the LHC, because there's more U's than D's. Top is basically symmetric. Actually, there's a small asymmetry, but I'm not sure exactly how big it is, but it's small enough that I don't need to worry about it. Single top is asymmetric, because again, there's more T's than T bars, because there's more U's than D's. And here's 36 to 2. That's not 36 to 21. It's 36 to 2. It's 18 to 1 asymmetry. So it's giant. In fact, if you really took this cross-section at this fiducial point, let's just call it the fiducial point, it would totally dominate the asymmetry. So that would be easily seen. Question is, can I divide this by 4 or 6 or 8 and still see it? And either by tagging or by imposing an energy cut, essentially, which is for the experts, HT here is the sum of the PTs of the lepton, the missing ET, and the first two jets. Either way, I end up with a situation, even dividing by 4, I should be able to see this thing. And the good thing about this measurement is that because you're using the asymmetry, uncertainties on this background, which are your biggest systematic error, are not a problem. Because by the time you get to this point, they're relatively small compared, they're comparable or smaller than your signal. So by using the charge asymmetry, you should be able to do very well. The experiments the next, 3 days later, put out papers putting limits on single top standard model. But they're really putting limits on this. And they cut really, really hard, which throws away most of our signal. So their method doesn't lead to good sensitivity. However, they do provide a couple of plots, which are sort of pre-selection before they do all those hard cuts. And from those plots, you can see that, yeah, they probably ruled it out at around the level of a factor of 4 below the fiducial point. But they do the measurement by throwing away all events with 3 or more jets. They only look at events with 2 and only 2 jets. And in the process, that hurts the signal here by a significant amount. Even though this, in principle, only has 2 jets, it's a lot of initial state radiation. So if they would just widen that to 2 and 3 jets, I think they would, and they would let a lot of top back in, but then they could use the asymmetry, which they don't do, and they would still do very well. So I think that when they recast the result, which they're going to do, Kyle Conroy is doing that at Atlas, they will get numbers comparable to 1/4 of the fiducial. But I think they could do even better than that if they would use our method, combine asymmetries with cross sections, and widen the selection, get bigger samples. I think they could do a really nice job of not only looking for this, but looking for a lot of other highly asymmetric signals that might be of this type. Okay, I've kept you too long, but I hope it was interesting, and thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much, Matt, for this very instructive talk. I think we still have 5 minutes.
Well, perhaps anyone who wants to leave should just leave, but I'm happy to answer questions for a few minutes.
Only one model which has no fine-tuning issues with flavor and which can explain this symmetry. It's the model of the triplets in the what color triplets seem as scalars,
yeah,
that you have to take also in the triplet representation of the flavor.
Right, so this is where you have u, c, and t, and you also have phi u, phi c, and phi t. And you couple u, c to phi t, c, t to phi u, and t, u to phi c.
Like you have looked at all the models. My knowledge is the only one that is
visible.
That's the
answer.
Is there any other one?
Eight and up.
In which representation?
You're not talking about axial. You're talking about scale? You're talking about
a vector.
Okay. Yeah. So axial.
It has S and T channel.
Oh, S and T channel.
It works pretty well.
So
we looked at all of them.
Right. That one, I
that one works the best.
I'm curious to hear about that one. I mean, one thing I will say is that all of these models, even so, what we really ruled out was some. Let me just make a comment.
Also, the sextet, right? It's just not true that it's only the triplet that works. And another thing, even though this model isn't fine too, not technically.
This one is
just no, it isn't. You just choose textures. That's not fine too. It's
not the term.
It's why you have to explain why the textures are only in this
way. Yeah, I agree with you. That's ugly.
This is
a different state.
It's not fine-tuned in the technical quantum mechanical sense. It's not like it's unstable.
I don't like it, but that's not fine-tuning. That's not what those ones mean. You have to choose your textures, so you only end up with certain
textures.
You basically your proto-CPMs, and then it rotates.
Okay, so you take a texture for your comet, it means you have some UV model.
You basically don't want a coupling into the second generation.
Yeah, but that's fine-tuning, sorry.
No, it isn't.
Because any measurable
fine-tuning... He's saying it's technical and natural.
It's technically
natural in principle, but if you start from a certain framework, you can...
It doesn't get ruined by radiative correction.
The first thing that I don't understand is what is the difference between this fancy word texture and just saying I want these couplings and not the other ones.
No difference. It's a question of radiative stability, right?
It's radiative
so
stability.
It's technically natural. If you set it at a high scale to 10 to the minus 6, for I don't think it has to be that low, for the second generation, are there radiative effects that generate order 1? That would be fine-tuned.
And so I think also...
This is just...
It's ugly.
When you have even an ugly idea, which explains several different experimental anomalies at the same time, it behooves us to double-check, because our vision of what's ugly could be wrong. In this case, we can do it, so it makes sense to do it. That's independent of the question of whether one can build a sensible model.
So
can
I phrase it that you kind of killed
so
UV?
We killed
Brian,
this,
you killed it,
but this is still okay.
Yeah.
Right? We only killed this couple.
But don't they come
this is still
alive.
No.
In their model, yes.
Okay.
But you can build other models that don't necessarily have this. Okay. So you're forced to this. Now, this is, you know, if you're just sort of forcing everything into the top, you know, you can say that's pretty unnatural too. And there, you know, you have now you're in SU2 that has TD and it doesn't have other things in the standard. I mean, you know, it's ugly. But the nice thing is that you can look for this. I mean, it's again, it's a matter of time. Within this year, we'll be able to rule all this stuff out because you can't prevent, if you have this, something like gluon, down quark, T, W prime, T bar D. Okay. Did I get the signs right? Yeah. Guaranteed. And in fact, that's true not only for this model, but for almost every model you can think of. Once you have this TUD, TDX coupling or UTX coupling, you always get a diagram like that. So the key is to take TT bar jet events and look at them. And the interesting thing here is it's asymmetric. Because you make more tops here because you have more Ds than anti-Ds. But the tops here, well, you say, what's the difference? There are tops here, there are anti-tops here. But these anti-tops have a different PT spectrum than those tops. They have a different origin. So I don't know, but it's possible that make this measurement the asymmetry will be important too. Asymmetry is going to be important all over the place.
So one thing that does bother me about this as well is it's clearly anomalous, right? It's just coupling to rights. So there's going to be some fermion content, some non-trivial paper structure.
Well, you can put it as TUV.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm curious, does this offend you at all?
I have not. I mean, my concentration has really been in this project on the experimental issue. I have not sat down to try. I mean, my guess is all these models would bother me and that there aren't any really good ones that I like. And even though it's true that this flavor model, I mean, we can argue about that one too. I mean, do we really like having these, you know, three scalars sitting at the...
It's okay.
It's not radiatively stable. Like, I mean, it's, you know, you reintroduce the Higgs problem. I mean, you know, it's not a great model. It's not bad. But the real question right now is experimental. We want to find out whether any of these things is true. The real issue is we haven't a forward backward asymmetry. We haven't been able to explain. And that is a question which is sort of model independent right now. And so, yes, we need a variety of different opportunities. And the fact is that almost all the time, or for a very wide variety of models, you get this. So this kind of search is a model independent type of search. That's good. And there's other things like it.
What about S-channel, heavy S-channel resonances?
So
there were some attempts.
You're starting to run into trouble with LHC measurements.
Yeah. So I think it's a good point to stop.
Yeah, we certainly. You could certainly chat.
Different